I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to Almost Famous, the podcast where I explore the subject of fame by talking to people who've experienced it themselves and ask them how it has affected their own journey as well as the lives of those around them. My guest today is comedian and actress Lulu Popplewell. When she was young, Lulu appeared in Love in a Cold Climate on the BBC and played Daisy in Richard Curtis' mega smash film Love Actually. As a proper grown-up, Lulu's branched out into comedy, making the finals of the Leicester Square New Comedian Award in 2016 and the Chortle Student Comedy Award in 2018, and appearing at the 2019 Edinburgh Fringe with her wonderfully named show, The Humble Bumhole. And on radio, Lulu played the part of Lyra in Radio 4's His Dark Materials trilogy. Lulu is also what I call a pure Almost Famous guest, as she is the sister of actress Anna Popplewell, who has appeared in the Chronicles of Narnia series, Mansfield Park, and Girl with a Pearl Earring, amongst many other things. I'd like to give a huge Almost Famous welcome to Lulu Popplewell. How are you?
Hello, I'm good. I've never been called a proper grown-up before. That was very pleasing.
I like to call everyone a proper grown-up because I'm so not one myself. Yeah. I refuse to admit any grown-up tendencies. What did you make of your intro? Did I fuck anything up? Did I miss anything out?
No, it's very impressive. I think you've listed almost everything I've ever done in 30 seconds, which is somewhat depressing. But
Well, you're one of our... many guests, I'd say, with a Wikipedia page. Yes. And I had to take a lot off that, but that can also lead to lies.
Well, my Wikipedia page until a couple years ago was an absolute crock of shit. Someone had written that I'd been on tour for Little House on the Prairie and that I was both Emma Watson and Daniel Radcliffe's stunt double. So I don't know who'd done that. But
that sounds amazing. And there's definitely no chance that it could have been you in a late night frenzy of bollocks writing.
No, I don't think so, because I have to admit I've tried to edit my own Wikipedia page and don't know how. So I possibly my mum trolling me. I don't know quite who put that on there.
I always ask all my guests, I know from all of our conversations before this what the answer is, but I have to ask, are you famous, Lulu Popplewell?
No.
So tell us a little bit about the experience you've had being in that massive film, which of course has been seen by everyone. You did, I mean, how old were you for the Love Actually years?
I was 10 or 11, so a long time ago. I'm 29 now. Yeah. So a really long time ago. Do you know what, at the time though, I have to say, when it was happening, I didn't experience it as that exciting because, I won't go too much into it, but because I grew up with siblings in films, mm-hmm. I at that point was like, well, yeah, well, we all get to do a film. Like, it, you know, at 10, I was like, well, now it's my turn.
So it's totally normal.
Yeah, yeah. And I'd sort of, I mean, like, you know, the week before I got cast in it, I think I'd gone onto a set and met Johnny Depp, because of, you know, knowing some producers of something my brother was in. So I feel like a real shit saying it. I mean, I sound awful now, but at the time I was like, well, yeah, it's my turn to be in a film.
No, I don't think that sounds awful at all, because obviously as a 10-year-old, you don't have any, you know, kids are so brilliant in that they don't have any filters. It's just the natural feeling of how it was. I mean, I feel like I have to ask how Johnny Depp was.
I bitterly disappointed, because of all the films I could have met Johnny Depp in, it was his least sexy role and he was in costume. It was the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Oh, yeah. He was not sexy in that.
And he mostly spoke to my brother, which was disappointing. But, you know.
So I will ask a question later about you being a pure Almost Famous guest and your sister, but so your brother's an actor as well?
My brother was in one film. He was in Peter Pan.
So you literally all just did get... You definitely just get one film.
Yeah, everyone gets a go. My sister got several goes. But yeah, so, you know, I at the time... I actually found a diary entry recently where I said, I got cast in my first film today, which is an incredibly precocious, pretentious thing. But I think, you know... Without context, when you're little, you just assume that's how it is. Yeah. That's the way it is in your family.
And looking back at yourself in hindsight then, not just with that diary entry in mind, would you describe yourself as a precocious child, and how did that come out if you were?
I think I'm making myself sound more precocious than I was. I was weird. I was a very weird little child.
In what ways?
I don't know. I got, without making it a mental health podcast, I was just very anxious and right. lashed out a lot, made lots of like very, I was with all my school reports saying, oh, Lulu clearly thinks differently from mm-hmm. other children. Mm-hmm. I think my sister was the precocious one and I was just the oddball.
Okay. And I wonder then in bringing it back to, so you mentioned the casting circumstance for Love Actually and stuff. Do you think being a little different, as your teachers said, allowed you to be freer in that kind of situation? You didn't care, you didn't feel nervous, you thought you were just going to get a film because that's what your brother had done, etc.?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I turned up to the audition and I don't think at any point I even read the lines. I just wanted to have a chat with Richard Curtis and ask him about things in his house.
Wow. So at your, how many auditions did you have? He was in your first audition?
I did a BBC thing before that, but that's I was going up for auditions all the time, and I think now I'd shit myself, but yeah. as a kid, whatever, there's no stakes.
Yeah. And so were you with an agency? What, how did it work? You wanted to be an actor, or your parents wanted you to be actors? How does that work?
No, my parents did not want us to be actors. they sent us to drama club to sort of help with our confidence and public speaking.
Nice.
My parents are not in the industry at all, and it completely backfired. And it wasn't one of those like
it backfired with you becoming this person.
Yeah, and then suddenly they're like, oh god, we've got to go and chaperone our kids in Australia or whatever. No, it wasn't, and it wasn't like a Sylvia Young or Stagecoach kind of thing. It was an absolute clusterfuck of a drama club where we mostly were just throwing things at the wall and eating biscuits. And but one day my sister got cast in something, and the drama teacher said, "Yeah, all right, I'll become an agent." And then she started an agency off the back of that. So,
wow! So,
yeah.
So throwing things at the wall and eating biscuits is the way forward to get people roles.
Yeah, absolutely. Don't try too hard, I think is the.
Wow, and so and were there any other alumni from that drama club? Or was it just your family who had the minerals to take it through to the next level?
No, there was a kid who was in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. She played Brooke Salt. There was a boy who was in The Mummy.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's still going, to be honest. I'm not really checked out.
That's a good hit rate.
Yeah.
I hope she was taking some kind of cut.
I believe she was, yeah. Okay. I think she looked at the business side of it.
That's a relief all around. And for a podcast called Almost Famous, I feel it would be remiss of me not to ask what the experience on set of Love Actually was like, what you remember. Is it something you regret? I mean...
No, I don't regret it at all. I mean, softly be it spoken, I think it's a shit film.
Right.
And
is that, can I ask though? Because I feel like everyone has that opinion of Love Actually now, right? But is that... and I feel like your opinion is more valid than most because you were involved. But I feel like everyone has that. And yet I would describe it as an eminently watchable film.
I think it's aged badly.
It's aged badly in terms of relationships and
yeah, all the
like
women
that,
in
sure.
it are sort of passive objects. Mm. I think that there was an article that described them as passive objects to be acquired. And on rewatching, it's not great.
Yeah. I mean, I think Richard Curtis has had that thrown at him quite a lot in terms of his films, hasn't he?
Yeah, but you also have to remember that he was writing in the context of the time. I mean, I don't know how he excuses more recent bits
right,
of work.
Right.
But, you know, it was what it was in 2003 or whenever it
yeah.
was out. But it's also not for me because I don't like cheese. So
right.
even...
I really do like cheese. Like I'm a rom-com crier, so that's
okay.
why I'm
oh,
happy
wow.
to, I'm happy to describe it as an eminently watchable film.
Okay. Well, no, and I'm glad people like it because
I mean, I feel like I'm almost playing devil's advocate as well because it's like it seems achingly uncool to suggest that maybe I enjoy the film Love Actually, but I think yeah, I mean there are parts of it that I can.
No, I mean you're allowed to. You're allowed to. I permit it. But
you hate.
But you
it.
Have terrible taste.
I'll accept that. But you so you dislike it. But you didn't have any feeling of that at the time, I assume.
No, I mean at the time I wasn't even allowed to watch it when it came out because it was a 15. So at the premiere,
Love Actually was a 15.
Yeah. There's nipples and everything.
I guess there's the bit with is his name Kevin, played by your man from My Family.
Chris Marshall.
Yeah, Chris Marshall. Is that his name? Oh, no,
Colin.
His name's Colin.
Don't act like you're not a super fan. It doesn't know all the names.
Sorry, but Colin with the sexy girls in America. I guess that's a little bit lewd and blue.
Well,
I'm surprised it's 15.
Yeah, things were sort of, I think, rated differently then as well. But I think there's some swears and
okay.
Like that. So yeah, we didn't even get to watch it at the premiere. We got walked down the red carpet and then taken off to dinner at Planet Hollywood. So
and
I didn't.
You didn't have
a.
You didn't throw your toys out the pram about that. I feel like if that was me, I'd be like, what?
No, I mean, I got to go and have fajitas at Planet Hollywood. I was much more interested in that than going to sit for a film.
Fair enough. Okay, so you didn't get to see it at the premiere, but you got to do red carpet and all that stuff. And then just going back in terms of what it was like on the set. I mean, I know you said it felt like it was the norm, but also...
And well, no, I mean, I was excited. I was definitely excited.
I mean, most importantly, how many days school did you get to miss?
Oh, 2 weeks. And okay. It was... What bliss. Yeah. And I remember at school, the form teacher said to me, what's the film you're doing in front of the class? I said, oh, it's got Hugh Grant and Colin Firth and Alan Rickman. And she sort of looked at me like I was lying because of the cast list.
Because obviously you must have been lying. That's such an unlikely thing to happen in any school class show and tell.
Yeah. And I could see people looking at me like, oh, this girl's a dick. But again, I sort of didn't have context then for how much of a dickhead thing it was to sort of list off the cast of the thing I was in. But no, when I was on set, I was excited to meet people, but the people I was excited to meet were very weird. So I was really excited to meet Chris Marshall, actually, because I loved My Family when I was little, because I had no taste developed then. And
basically, you hate the mainstream, is what you're saying.
let's just be honest about
you're not
family.
Gonna like you're not gonna like Mrs. Brown's Boys either, I don't think.
It's for some people, and that is nice for them. Yeah. The end. But it's it was so weird. I had to get Emma Thompson, who I wasn't fazed by at all. She led me up to Chris Marshall, holding my hand, saying, "I've got someone who's really excited to meet you."
That's
and he was
so
like
cute.
Looking around the room at like Rowan Atkinson and Hugh Grant, and he was like, "Are you me? Are you sure?"
That's nice.
Yeah,
that's nice from him as well. Bit of self-deprecation.
Yeah, and I remember meeting Hugh Grant as well, because Richard introduced me to him, and he said, "Oh God, do I have to speak to her? I hate children."
Non-ironically,
which I thought was really funny.
Oh, that is funny. That is funny. I mean, he was definitely in his phase of mainly just being a kind of man about town back then. I think he's actually got some children now, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Well, it's, I mean, and then in terms of like, I mean, because you're talking to someone here who's never done a film, or I would just be, I think especially at the age of 10, I would be shitting myself about fucking up and stuff like that. Was there any element of that, or you just...
No, I don't, again, like, I just don't think I was an anxious child, but about quite weird things and stuff that as an adult would be normal to be anxious about.
Mm.
It just didn't occur to me
that
could fuck it up. I think it wasn't until I was 13, 14... But then I sort of started to get nervous about performing or be aware of any of that.
Yeah.
Also, as a kid on set, you just get treated really nicely. So, because they're aware that they want to get the best result out of you. So, even if you're a tiny part, which I was, you get treated like a little...
And was the food excellent? The food options
I don't actually
excellent.
Remember the
what?
Food.
I mean, I feel like all I'd think about is how good the food was and stuff.
The food on the Narnia set, I remember being... Very good.
Okay, that's important. I feel like the food is the most important thing. And you said you didn't get to watch it at the time. Do you remember, I guess, I'm trying to put myself in your shoes, basically, as a 10-year-old, and maybe that's what the audience would want to know about as well. Do you remember what it was like going back to school when it had come out and people from your school had seen it, and did people change how they were to you?
I think there was... gentle ribbing in the years that followed. At the time, the year it came out, I don't think many of my classmates were the right age to be watching
it. Because
they
wouldn't have seen it either.
Yeah, but it was around sort of 13, 14, and everyone, you know, it's on every bloody Christmas. And then I'd get sort of lobster jokes thrown at me, and I'd find it quite embarrassing.
Because you were famously dressed in the lobster suit.
Yes, that's my claim to shame, is being a Christmas crustacean. and because it was such a small part, I didn't quite know how to react to it, because I didn't know whether to do like faux humility or whatever, because I did feel genuinely humble. Like, well, it was 2 weeks of work, it was nothing, and I got it because, you know, I was chatty in the audition.
Yeah. And then I saw a little bit, I'm jumping forward now a bit, but I saw a little bit in a bio of your Edinburgh show last year that you would, I think you'd written the bio months earlier, so you weren't sure exactly what you were going to do.
Yeah.
But you said you might talk about that. Is it something you've since talked about in your comedy?
I have a bit, mostly because of the article which I've sent you, the BuzzFeed one.
Mm-hmm. We'll get there.
Because that sort of came up. But I talked about it on stage in the context of feeling a bit weird at school, because I always felt like I was... doing something a little bit different and a little bit wrong, and How Love actually became this thing I felt I'd done wrong because people were making fun of me. I now realise they, you know, it was all lighthearted. But yeah.
And I wonder if that's anything to do with, so things that we've talked about before in this podcast with people, that kind of feeling of, I mean, I guess fame is a strong word. I mean, you will have experienced an element of fame, even if it's just in your school or about your friendship circle or whatever, or having watched, you know, having had to watch that film with people and people say, you know, you're in that famous film or whatever. But there is an element, having spoken to lots of people about fame, of an element of shame that comes with that feeling of being out there or putting yourself out there or yeah, being on some kind of pedestal. Maybe that's what that was.
Sure. And for me, as I say, like, I definitely don't think fame is a word that fits me. I'm not famous, but I have experienced it vicariously. But yeah, people pointing out something you've done, it's very awkward to react to, even something as small fry to my experience. It's sort of knowing how to arrange your face and how to sound and make sure you sound grateful that they've noticed, but also humble, but also like you're proud of yourself. You can't get it right.
And then having been in a film, a huge film so early, do you think that made you want success in that kind of industry or in the TV or film or comedy industry more? Do you think it led to you wanting to get involved in comedy, or do you think you were put off by it?
No, I absolutely wanted to get into it. Like, I wanted to act since I was five. Like, I was the main part in my school nativity, and I was like, right, this is for me. But I sort of gave up on the acting thing because, as I say, like 13, 14, I became sentient, and the anxiety of it was too much. And then I started around that age going to the Edinburgh Fringe every summer, and I realised that comedy was the thing I really loved.
Right. And when did you first do your... When was your first gig and what got you into it? Did you do a course or anything like that?
I did do a course.
I also did a course. So I'm not ashamed of the course.
What was your course?
I did the Amuse Moose course with Logan Murray.
Oh, okay, cool. Love a bit of J.G. Hills. So...
She's a whole separate episode.
Yeah, absolutely.
She did once tell me I had star quality. It was in the back of a taxi.
Well, you are...
She'd not seen me perform at the time. She was just basing it on what I looked like.
Yeah, handsome young white men, very much.
I think that's... I mean, I appreciate you saying handsome. I think that it was more the fact that I was there.
You're just present.
Present white men, yeah.
No, she's an interesting one. But I did the Soho Comedy Lab thing. And I've been putting off doing comedy for years. Yeah. Basically, from the first show I ever saw in Edinburgh, I was like, right, I want to do this. And that was age 13, and then... didn't start till I was 25.
What were you waiting for, do you think?
For self-confidence, to be honest. And I had a bit of a bumpy ride in the middle. Like as I mentioned before, like I'm in recovery now, so there was all that in the way. Mm-hmm. Wasn't very well at uni. Because I went to the university I went to because the comedy was good there. Mm-hmm. Didn't do a single. I didn't get on stage.
Which uni was that?
Cambridge.
I believe the university. I believe the comedy is good there.
Yeah,
I hear the footlights do quite well.
Yeah, although now I'm quite proud that I didn't do the footlights because everyone. It's not true, but everyone in the industry seems to think that gives you an automatic.
Yeah, there's a backlash at the moment. I was reading stuff about that today. Lots of backlash against that snobbery.
Yeah,
I think, is the
which I have mixed feelings about because I think it does. Like, obviously, it helps, but it doesn't. It's not like an open door into the industry.
Have to be good.
You still have to be good, but it is. Basically, what the footlights provided was lots of gigs and lots of practice time in a safe place for people. So it would have been good to do, but I'm quite proud of myself that I just did it on the open mic circuit.
So you did your course, and presumably, like most courses, the most important thing about the course is that at the end you have to do a 5-minute gig, right?
Right, but I started gigging from day dot on the course.
Oh, smart move. So, I wish I'd done that.
Yeah, and the day I started, I was like, right, I'm booking in 4 of these a week, 5. Like, I wanted to make up for lost time, so
okay,
I'd done already about like 30 gigs by the time it got to the point of our final show.
So almost like doing the course and getting up in front of other people gave you suddenly that like,
yeah,
I'm driven, I'm gonna do it straight away.
Yeah,
okay, really good. I really am jealous of that. I wish I'd done that because I had the standard thing of that showcase gig being like so good because obviously it's full with your friends and family and whatever, and I definitely I came off stage just being like I've found
it,
I've found it, I've nailed it, I've completely nailed it. And then my second gig, which was on like the next week at a place called the Malcolm Hardy's Wibbly Wobbly Boat in
you couldn't make
in,
that
like,
up
Stratford. It doesn't exist anymore, unfortunately, but it was in Stratford before Stratford was nice Stratford.
Yeah,
it was like dodgy, and I remember doing the same set exactly the same way, the same performance, and literally just being stared at by people and just being like, okay.
But at least you have that first good one to carry you.
Well, yeah, but it just made me think, and I feel like the first 2 years at least of me doing stand-up was me just trying to work out how audiences work and how rooms work and what you need to notice. And
I think I'm still working that out.
I don't think you ever necessarily work it out. But what I really remember is for the first few years just being like, if this starts badly, I do not have the skill to turn it around.
Yeah. And that for me is something I've maybe only learned in the last year, because I would get knocked at the beginning and then be like, I've just got to say all the words and get off stage. Yeah. And they smell that as well.
Yeah, I don't know if I've said this before, but I did a gig at the Comedy Store in LA.
Oh, wow.
Which was just because I was out living there. And my friend was out there for a week as well. So he was in the crowd filming it. It was just an open mic. And I was so nervous, I forgot my name. Like, so when I got up on stage and said, hi, I'm... And then just went, moved on. And afterwards, my mate came up to me and went, did you forget your name?
Did it read as a joke?
Not at all. It read as in, this guy should not be here and it's only going to get worse from here, which is kind of exactly what happened. So you decided, you had an idea early that you wanted to get into comedy, and then you have done. Do you have like a career path in mind? Do you have goals that you want to achieve? What would they be? Are you willing to tell us?
Sure. I mean, look, I haven't broken the back of the industry yet. But I, before lockdown, I did feel like I was starting to get there. I was doing nicer gigs. And
yeah.
I've tried the circuit a bit, and it's I have a lot of respect for people that do it. It's not for me. So I've worked out by doing. That's
right.
Not
and me. for the audience who don't know, so basically, do you mean in terms of doing the club
gigs around the country?
Yeah.
And it's really, and people often talk about circuit comedians in a kind of snobby way, and I actually think they are some of the most talented people out there, because it's really hard.
Yeah.
And you've got to have material that will sort of work anywhere. Whereas I've now started doing more like artsy London gigs, which is a bit of a cop out, but you know, I am an artsy London cunt, so that's sort of like...
I didn't say yes, and it's a cop out. No, I know what you mean. There is a difference, and I've spoken to other people who've talked about recently I was talking to a comedian who's like, I don't do the circuit at all anymore, I just do Edinburgh. And it's like they just spend a year kind of writing their Edinburgh stuff because they know in Edinburgh it's a different crowd.
Yeah, and I grew up watching comedy in Edinburgh. That was my annual pilgrimage, so that's more my I want to make good Edinburgh shows, and then I want to be on panel shows, I want to write stuff, I want to act, like, you know. I'm hoping it will come back together cohesively. And I'll get back on screen as well, but
well, I have no doubts. And also for the audience, I should say, I think in terms of the club, so definitely there are lots of people who do Edinburgh but also do the clubs, but there are also, I'd say, or at least there certainly were when I last did stand-up, which was about 5-6 years ago, there were club comics who literally have 20 minutes of material and have been doing that 20 minutes for maybe 20 years. Mm. And it always does really, really well. And they earn, you know, they live off doing the clubs Friday and Saturday nights.
Yeah.
And that's how it works. So that they're the kind of like differing types of comics, I think. I think that's kind of what we're talking about.
Why did you stop 5 or 6 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, it might be worth going into a bit more when we do our talk about our reviews I've actually only recently been able to be honest with myself about why I stopped, which was I wasn't writing enough. So over lockdown, I found I hadn't written anything for years, and over lockdown in terms of jokes, and over lockdown I found like a method to write, and I wrote more in the first 2 weeks of lockdown than I'd written probably in the 8 years I was doing stand up.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Suddenly found.
What have you found?
It's only like a method that works for me. I mean, it goes back to something. It's not as simple as this, but it goes back to something I heard Gary Delaney on Stuart Goldsmith's podcast years ago. Just say, write for half an hour every day. Write for half an hour every day. And at the time, I remember thinking, I don't even know where to start.
Yeah,
exactly. Like, I don't know what topics to talk about. I don't know whatever. And for me, the kind of method is more about a way to find topics to talk about. Mm. But yeah, over lockdown, I wrote for like half an hour every day. And that is what's made me think again, I might start going back into it if the comedy circuit ever starts up again.
I mean, RIP live comedy.
Well, exactly.
We're talking about a bygone era.
Exactly. But it's not right to praise lockdown and COVID, but without that, I wouldn't have started writing again. So
silver lining.
But yeah, I was getting paid to do it. I'd not done an Edinburgh show, but I was okay, actually. I think I didn't think I was very good, but I think I was probably better than I gave myself credit for. Mm. But I just wasn't writing new stuff. And I ended up, you know, I had 20 minutes, but it was 20 minutes that I kind of garnered together from about 8 years of stuff.
Yeah.
So
and then you lose love for it.
And then I lost the love for it, and I had a bad gig, and then I just never did it again.
Aww.
Now, before we get on to the important part of our reviews, which I'm very excited about, we mentioned your sister briefly and mentioned you being a pure, almost famous guest because your sister has done lots of stuff.
Yeah.
So the only question I really want to ask is, what's it like for you as the sibling of somebody who is, I don't know, famous, would you say, or certainly well-known in the public eye?
Yeah, I mean, she's famous for a very small F, I think.
Okay.
If you say, like, oh, my sister's Anna Popwell, people don't know her name.
Right.
But if you say, like, oh, she's the one in Narnia with the big tits and the bow and arrow, they're like, oh, I've seen, yeah, that one.
But if you if you said it at a dinner of BAFTA or something, or full of actors and pretentious, in my eyes, pretentious actory types, they'd probably know her because they watch all the stuff.
Sure. I mean, I think she is known within her industry. It's very hard to know how people are seen.
Yeah.
And by which people. But, you know, people are vaguely aware of her. A lot of people saw the Narnia film. She's been in other stuff that's been quite successful as well.
Yeah.
She's been, you know, in the 3 series of an American TV show recently. So.
Amazing.
I love her to bits, but I hated her growing up. So I was very jealous of her.
Some envy there, yeah.
Yeah, very. And like, she was...
Did that affect your relationship?
Yeah, I think it did. I was. She was sort of very high achieving. And also, I don't think ever really that interested in acting. It sort of just happened to her, which was
the worst.
Yeah, no, she stole my dream.
Yeah.
Sneaky bitch. But... now I'm older, I'm like, well, I want to do comedy, and she's doing her thing, and,
yeah.
You know, it's completely fine. But
have you ever talked to her about that, how difficult that was for you when you were growing up?
Yeah,
and stuff?
Quite a few times in anger. It was difficult because it's a lot of people stopping us on the street and asking me to take the picture.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was one year where the Oxford Street Christmas lights were Narnia sponsored, and there was her face up.
Yeah.
Above Topshop, and I just thought, oh, fuck this. Like,
That was the last straw.
Yeah, and it's, you know, again, very childish, because at the time I was like, she's done nothing to deserve this, but, like, what does that mean? Like,
yeah, it's a very honest appraisal of how it feels to be the sibling of someone famous, though.
Yeah,
and
particularly if you have similar ambitions. I think
yeah,
if you've got
exactly.
your own path already, then that's fine, but...
I wonder if it comes back to, though, what you were saying about how you felt going into that audition for Love Actually when you were a kid, which was like, you didn't give a shit, you just thought, you know, you were laid back, you didn't care.
Yeah.
And then you said about her, you know, she's not that bothered about it. It probably does subconsciously come across in like auditions and stuff, that kind of lack of, it's like when you know when you've gone on a date with someone and you really fancy them and you text them 6 times without them replying.
Yeah,
like the whiff of desperation. Now, I'm not suggesting that you have the whiff of desperation in auditions or whatever, but that probably it comes across more if she genuinely doesn't give that much of or doesn't feel that strongly for it, then it probably relaxes her, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, as she got older, I think she was like, oh, I want this to be my career, and she did care very much. But yeah, you might be right, there might be something in that. I I honestly though, she was far too perfect for her own good. Like, she was like head girl, lacrosse team, leading all the school plays. Like, you know, that kind of bitch you just want to slap.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'm going to get one of those emails saying don't put that in.
No, I've said it on other podcasts.
Okay, good.
I love her.
I'm not cutting that out then.
Love her to bits, but I'm the fun one.
I think we all feel about our siblings like we want to give them a good slap every so often anyway.
Yeah, lovingly.
That's what it's all about. Okay, so a big part of this series of Almost Famous, something I wanted to bring in, is the idea of, and it comes from the fact that in most interviews I've done so far with people, I've asked what the worst thing about being in the public eye or being famous is, and they've all talked about being negatively written about by the press or lied about in the press. Mm. So I wanted to open that out and get all of my guests to bring something with them where it's an example of something that kind of has affected the motivation involved in being a creative person because it's a negative. In this case, a review. But before we get on to the review, you also brilliantly, and as you mentioned before, sent me this BuzzFeed article.
Mm.
And the BuzzFeed article ranks all 50 characters in the film Love Actually from 50 down to 1. Now, your character, Daisy, comes in at number 49.
Yeah, so crucially not last.
Crucially not last. And your part of the article just says this: 49, Daisy, Karen's daughter, boring and sad.
Boring and sad. It's so damning.
I guess the only question that it's worth asking based on that, because that's obviously just silly, is there an element of instinct that you can't stop yourself from taking that personally and being like, that's almost, you know, they're saying that about you rather than your character?
So luckily this came out at a time when I'd started doing comedy and I was able to laugh at myself, and it was like my partner at the time put it up as his profile picture because he thought it was so funny.
Brilliant.
The one thing about
partner of the time, I know. So
yeah. Oh no.
The next day it was over.
Yeah, he's long. He's dead. And
rightly so.
He pointed it out to me, and the only reason it feels personal, like it's about me rather than the characters, is the Lobsters as a group or somewhere else on the list much higher up. So I've been singled out as boring and sad. But no, that was just funny. That was just a sort of a silly thing.
And for context, as you said, it's worth saying Lulu was only ahead of the character Harry, played by Alan Rickman, who came in at 50. The article said this about him: no disrespect to the dead. Alan Rickman famously is
BuzzFeed
dead.
BuzzFeed really is the height of journalism.
Yeah,
it?
No disrespect to the dead, but Harry was the fucking worst. His wife is cool as hell and he still tries to fuck with Mia. God, fuck this dude.
Yeah.
So probably, yeah, like you said, more of an explanation of what BuzzFeed is like, really. Yeah.
It's one 21-year-old's opinion of a not very good film. I think I can live with it.
Yeah, and I think by saying 21, you're probably doing the intern at BuzzFeed a favour. Probably more like 16, 17.
Likely.
Okay, so moving on to what you also sent me, which is, like we mentioned in the intro, you got to the final of the Leicester Square Theatre New Comedian of the Year. Quite a well-respected new act competition. I wanted to talk a bit before actually doing the review for the audience how important new act competitions can be for comedians just starting out.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly remember seeing them as like a rite of passage and desperately wanting to do well in them.
Mm.
Is that something you felt as well?
I do. And I mean, now I wouldn't touch competitions with a barge pole. I think it got to the point that they started to destroy my soul and love of comedy. But at the beginning, there are no obvious routes into the industry, and it's one of the few things that's like a structured thing you can do at the start.
Yeah.
To you know, move up the ladder,
yeah,
the invisible
noticed.
Ladder. So I did all of them for the first couple of years.
Yeah. And yeah, like I said, the Leicester Square one is pretty highly sought after. This review is by Julia Chamberlain for Chortle. It's from November 2016. Lulu, I'm going to read it. And then we'll talk about it a little bit. I should say, you're already sighing uncomfortably.
I hadn't read it. I read it once when it came out, and then I read it again when I sent it to you a couple of days ago, and it hurt my bumhole. that won't be better now out loud, but off you go.
To make you and the audience feel, although you already know this, to make the audience feel less uncomfortable about this, we will then afterwards also read a review of mine from a competition final.
Great.
We'll level the playing field. So here is Lulu's review. By Julia Chamberlain, who's known for being a bit of an arsehole reviewer, I have to say.
Oh no, we love Julia.
Well, I don't know her
actually,
personally.
Actually, no, fuck it, she doesn't book anything anymore, fuck her.
I don't know her personally at all. I just know that from back in the day, I remember her seeing some arseholic reviews that she wrote. Not the worst reviewer, but up there. Okay, here we go. An achingly vulnerable character obsessed with scurvy, being abandoned by men and ending up in the friend zone, Lulu Popplewell's particular offering engendered more sympathy than hilarity. The character may work better by cumulative effect. I could see her appearances punctuating a sketch show, commentating from her very particular view of the world. But in a 5-minute slot in a comedy competition, she got a bit lost. Okay. I feel like it's worth asking, how did you feel the night went before you saw that
terrible,
review?
Really bad. But okay. For context, I was really new when I did it. I was by far the newest actor in the bill. One of the girls in the bill had just been touring with Catherine Ryan. Other people I knew were getting spots at the store. This was my 40th gig. Mm-hmm. I was a baby. And I went into that competition being like, well, I might get past first heat and that'll be good for myself.
Yeah, how many heats were there? It's worth telling the audience. How many different gigs do you have to do to get to the final?
I think final is the fifth.
Amazing.
So they've
sorted out the wheat from the chaff by that point.
Yeah, but it was a bit rogue that I got through and mm-hmm. lucky. And I think David, who ran it, just sort of very kindly saw something in me. And I go back now and I MC those.
Why do you say rogue and lucky then? Is that just you being down on yourself? Because it doesn't sound like there's anything lucky at all.
Competitions are the opinion of a few people. And I had to be reminded that when I didn't get through them.
Right.
And it depends what they're looking for. It depends who else is in your heat. Depends how the audience are feeling on the day, the position you get picked to go in. So, you know, there's a lot of factors at play. And I was so new. I'd only done open mic pub gigs. And suddenly I was at Leicester Square Theatre with, you know,
a few 400 people.
400 people. Richard Herring was comparing.
Amazing.
And I was on 10th. So I had too much time to get in my head about it.
So I've read the whole review. I was going to read the whole review for context as well, but it was just too long. But yeah, I should say Lulu was on 10th. And something that I really know from those things is people get bored. People do get bored. And then also, I think what you're about to say is you get a lot of time to think about it. And also, I mean, this may not happen to everyone, but it certainly happens to me, or used to happen to me. I would watch the other people go on. And if it went really well for them, especially if it went really well for them just before I went on, then I was already dying in my head. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I'd already put it down on, I've got no chance.
It's what you were saying earlier, when if it goes wrong at the beginning, you forgot your name and you just can't turn it around. And I did not have the skills then to do that. And I went up and the mic got stuck in the stand and I couldn't get it out. And I can feel
it in my stomach. Yeah, I can feel the anxiety in my stomach.
Yeah, my bum hole, she hurts. And I didn't make a joke about it. I didn't make anyone feel comfortable. And then I was also doing material that was very self-deprecating and probably would work better now because I'm confident on stage. But if you're not confident and you're doing material that's down on yourself and a bit weird, it just comes across as she said, it engenders more sympathy than hilarity. Yeah. Which, as you were saying it, I realise is another way of saying boring and sad. Across the board.
So, I think what's interesting to ask here is, because this is what happened to me as well, I didn't really read my review that I'm going to go into for years. I think I only read it once when I first saw it and then literally didn't read it again until I brought it back out for this podcast a few weeks ago, right?
I'm excited.
When I first looked at it and thought, I hope there's an opportunity to bring this out. So what I would say, because the reason I'm saying that is what I would say about yours that I also felt with mine when I reread it is actually there's a lot of positive there. But I bet when you first read it or when you hear it, you don't hear any of that positive.
No.
So all the stuff about seeing you in a sketch show, that's a real positive. That's a real, I could see this person being successful enough to be on television.
It's selective hearing maybe.
Yeah,
but I chose to think, oh God, she's trying to find something nice to say because she feels sorry for me.
She was doing a shit sandwich.
Yeah. But, maybe it is selective hearing. But I think also it's because I knew how upset I was with the gig at the time.
Right.
And after I read that review, I told you I was doing comedy 4 or 5 nights a week. I really wanted to do it. I didn't gig for a month after that because I was so knocked by it.
No, that's a really common thing for the audience who haven't done stand-up before. It's it's very, very difficult to get back on the horse after you've had a terrible gig. I mean, I back in my early days where I didn't know how to drag it back, I was dragged off the stage by the MC twice.
Sorry, I was drinking water, that's why I made
fine.
That noise.
No, that's absolutely fine. It was really the right noise to
what
make.
What had you done?
Well, the first time I feel like wasn't all my fault. So the first, and I think I may have even regaled this audience with this before, but there was a very famous gig at the Thistle Hotel in Leicester Square run by the guy who I can't remember his name now, but he got arrested, but basically he would flyer Leicester Square with pictures of Michael McIntyre and Stuart mm-hmm. Lee on the front of the flyer saying gig here.
Yeah.
And then when inevitably tourists, only tourists from other countries would come down and pay £15 for a ticket.
Yeah.
It would just be eight open micers not being paid doing 5 minutes each.
Yeah,
right?
I was like, well, have you seen Crashing with Pete Holmes?
No, I haven't.
You should definitely watch it. It's amazing. But the whole thing they have there is they fly a, you know, with like Kevin Hart, and people say, oh, does he play here? And it's like, well, he's played in this area.
City. Yeah, exactly. So it's exactly, yeah, that might even be based on that. And then what happened was all of the eight open micers were dragged into the kitchen of this hotel. And the MC guy said, here are the things you're not allowed to talk about. You're not allowed to talk about the ticket price. You're not allowed to talk about the fact the audience are all foreign. You're not allowed to talk about the fact that you're not being paid. You're not allowed to talk about the fact that the flyers are with famous people on, whatever. And it was like red rag to a bull. So I went up pretty early and just said, here are the things I'm not allowed to talk about. And he dragged me off stage. And then we almost had a fisty fight in the back.
Amazing.
And then the second one was in... here's an example of the things you have to learn as well. The second one was on Broadway Market,
mm-hmm.
downstairs in the summer, I think, of a very hot bar. But the thing you kind of learn is hipster East London and hipster East Londoners do not want to laugh at comedy. It's a thing. They're too cool.
Yeah.
And everything
might be offensive.
Well, especially now. But back then, I don't know if it was an offensive thing, but it was just like they didn't want to be there and they didn't want to laugh. And I was deciding that the way to deal with that was to call them out on it.
Mm.
And I think I may have even ended up calling out the MC who was just sat in the audience at the time saying, what's your problem kind of thing. So I got dragged off there anyway. Yes. So you didn't get back on stage for about a month. Do you feel like you learnt anything from it? Do you feel like in hindsight there was truth to it, the review?
Absolutely. I think that basically the review is saying, she just seemed incredibly vulnerable and we weren't comfortable with that. Mm. And
you felt that.
And
at the time.
I wasn't incredibly vulnerable, I wasn't comfortable with it. But it taught me that I couldn't, as I say, I couldn't do really self-deprecating stuff until the audience knew that I was actually comfortable saying it and then it was a persona rather than someone bleeding all over the stage.
Yeah.
So it was helpful, but quite a tough love kind of way.
Well, thank you so much for bringing it with you. I appreciate that. Here to Level It Up is mine. It's from the, I did the Comedy Cafe New Act of the Year Final 2011.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so I think to get in that you had to have won. I guess you had to have won the Comedy Cafe New Act Night, which was every Wednesday,
mm-hmm.
which I had done. And then I guess, because presumably there were at least 50 winners of that, presumably then you were picked. I guess you had a 1 in 5 chance, mm-hmm. I guess. I don't know. And this is by Steve Bennett, who I think it's fair to say people would say is probably one of the cuntiest reviewers of all.
I mean, I am yet to do my Edinburgh debut show, so for the record, Steve Bennett is a wonderful man and has excellent taste. And
Steve
Bennett, brilliant review.
So I got to the semi-final of the BBC New Comedy Competition, I think that year as well, actually, and Steve Bennett was the judge.
I did that as well.
Steve Bennett was the judge of my heat in Belfast. Bizarrely, I had to go to Belfast because there wasn't space anywhere else. And I was runner-up to Andrew Ryan that night.
Mm-hmm.
And we were in the bar afterwards. And I was obviously buzzing. Like, I'd gone a long way. It's quite a prestigious thing. Absolutely buzzing. And I'd never met Steve Bennett. And I went up to him and went, oh, nice to meet you. And he was very, very dour. And then I said, and this is fucking naive of me. Of course it is. But I was buzzing, like I said. So I couldn't stop myself. I was like, oh, so, you know, you've been the judge for all of these heats. What's, you know, what was it like tonight? What was the standard like compared to everyone else? And he's like, poor.
It yeah, I mean, poor. I heard him saying that about my friend's heat when I was... But I think it's difficult for Steve because he's around these comedians all the time. They all kind of want something out of him. So he's
Do
got
we,
lots of...
Well...
I mean, they don't want to piss him off because he holds cards.
He holds the keys
and,
a little bit.
And so he's sort of got these people that aren't quite... Maybe probably aren't quite friends, but treat him as friends. So I think it is... I have some sympathy for him.
You're very nice. You're very kind.
But I also I'm saying this because I want him to...
No, and right. So, I mean, I also saw... They've released on Chortle this week some old reviews that they did of people like McIntyre and everyone and that were really bad.
That they got wrong, yeah.
And so it's worth us saying, I think the key to these things is bouncing back from them. Anyway, here is my review. Barnaby Slater hinted at something interesting by immediately bringing up the subject of his girlfriend being pregnant by another man. I've been desperately trying to remember what that joke was. I really cannot remember at all. But ideas that he'd reveal much more about himself are immediately dashed as he plunged into a morass of abortion and paedophile jokes that have long lost their ability to shock. Especially when written with such apparent cold calculation as this. There's a nice bit of structure to the set and the occasional good line, but smugly adding, you're right, that is a very funny joke, after a modest laugh, does nothing to boost the likability of this cynical act.
Oh!
So...
How does that make you feel?
Yeah, well, so, like I said, I mean, obviously I'm in a cold sweat having just read it, but it is hot. But like I said, well, it is. But like I said, well, do you know what? I do write in a way. The way that I would describe my writing is I start it in truth and then it meanders off into now what some people would call dark territories. Mm. Some people don't like the word dark. I'm not sure how I feel about it. But certainly shock value, I think, is a fair part of what makes me laugh. I like comedians who shock.
Yeah.
And those kind of jokes make me laugh and are naturally how I write. I spent loads of time while doing comedy trying to write in a different way, wanting to be a more observational comic, wishing I was able to write in a whimsical way. But that's the way I write. And actually, you know, that had, I got to that final. I'd got to another final. I'd been doing quite well. I was getting paid gigs. Just not everybody likes what you do. That's never going to be the way it is.
But it's something that stands out.
Then, and that makes you laugh.
Yeah, exactly.
But at the time, absolutely, I didn't see that. And I just saw all the negatives. I didn't see any of the stuff about structure.
Yeah.
And I wanted, like you said, I wanted him to give me a good review and I was devastated about it. And definitely it really set me back. And I just, you know, like I said, I just thought I need to try and write in a different way and I need to... it doesn't matter. I would say to myself, it doesn't matter that people are laughing in the room. What matters is that Steve Bennett says it's not the right comedy to do.
And we do give a lot of power to these people. And as, it's the same thing with competition judges as well as critics. That they, yes, they know a lot about comedy, but they still have subjective opinions and tastes. And you can't please everyone with it.
No, of course. And also, obviously, you have to always tell yourself how desperate they must have been to be comedians as well and just cut and just
sure,
don't do
if
it.
Sure, if you're having one of those days.
Yeah, exactly.
I like that he said it was the jokes about, what was it, rape and paedophilia?
Abortion and paedophile jokes.
Were cold and calculated. I mean, as opposed to, like, what, with field research? I mean, it's not, like, from, you know.
Well, I think basically what was happening back then is I'd realised that to deliver the jokes I was writing, I had to be incredibly high status and just be totally ice cold about it. And that's how I was. Like you discussed with your stuff before, I think if I tried, if I'd given any kind of semblance of a self-deprecating demeanor while delivering that material, it would have just been completely confusing as a persona. So no, that side of it is fair. I think there's, you know, there's a lot of fair about it. And the jokes probably just weren't that cleverly written at the time as well.
But the problem is they are new act competitions
and we're
new, and they can't review them by giving lots of lovely caveats. But equally, I worry that people reading, finding that review of me out of context, I really want to say, oh, but I'd only done 40 gigs and I didn't know what I was doing. And you know, but
you can't explain it away.
No.
You can't explain it away. Lulu, it's been an amazing chat. Thank you so much. I'm going to ask you the question I ask everyone at the end. And I guess we'll have to base this on your... how did you describe it? Your little piece of fame from when you were younger, I guess. I don't know. The final question I always ask is, knowing all that it entails and with the benefit of hindsight, would you give up your experience of being in the public eye if you had the chance? You'd have exactly the same life, but you'd just never have been in Love Actually, I think, is the question.
No, I wouldn't.
You wouldn't change it?
I'm comfortable with it now, and it's a part of me, and hopefully it will help me get an agent someday.
Well, exactly, and it breeds material. Thanks so much for coming on the show. Now, is there anything you'd like to plug? Where can the audience find your work or see you back, imagining COVID ever ends?
Yeah, I mean, in the future, if there are gigs again, all the stuff I'm doing is on my Twitter, so which is @Lulu_PopperWell.
Are you an Insta person? Are you on
that? No, my dog's on Instagram, but I'm not.
Well, plug your dog's Instagram.
Okay, so my dog's @DottieTheMultiPoo. She's very sweet, and she's got a reasonable number of followers.
Okay, more than you?
None for me. I don't even
Well,
have my own Instagram.
More than you on Twitter, though?
No, not quite.
Okay,
but she's
well, that's
getting
a relief, but the MultiPoo will get there eventually. Guys, thanks so much for listening to this episode of Almost Famous. Please do press the subscribe button, rate the podcast, leave us a comment too. Find us on Instagram @AlmostFamousThePodcast and on Twitter @PodAlmostFamous. And also check out my new podcast called It's Your Funeral. A slightly more lighthearted look at the most important day of my individual guests' afterlives. Check that out and thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time. Or hear from you next time. Or you'll hear from us next time. That doesn't make any sense. Next time. Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.